Hi, I'm Matt Sorensen, CMO at Clearbit.
And I'm Alex McCaw, CEO of Clearbit.
And you're listening to the Manager's Handbook Podcast.
Here at Clearbit, we've been writing a book on management as part of our internal training program with a goal of developing world-class managers.
The handbook brings together what's worked for us over the past 5 years and everything we've learned from our failures.
Each month, we'll be releasing a new episode of the pod, along with a written chapter of the handbook. You can find this all at themanagershandbook.com.
In today's pod, we're covering chapter 4, working as a team. Specifically, we'll dive into team agreements, timelines, meetings, decision-making, remote teams, and we'll finish up by thinking about how we measure manager performance. And joining me today, as always, is Alex McCaw, Clearbit's founder, CEO, and aspiring Python engineer.
Good to be here, Matt.
So without further ado, let's hop in. Let's start with agreements, which can be, on the surface level, a somewhat boring topic, but it's really important.
Yeah, I would say, Matt, what do you think are the most important aspects to a team's performance?
Great question. I think when we think about team's performance, it is, can we rely on everyone that we're working with kind of to do what they say they will, but just kind of be reliable? The whole team has to show up, right? Everything in creative work is a team project. There's no winning with just one person.
Right. I would say it all comes back down to trust.
Totally.
Great teams trust each other. And as soon as you have agreements being broken, people not doing the things they said they would, that trust disintegrates.
Yeah, I actually think that helps a lot. If we start thinking about agreements as how do we build and maintain trust, suddenly it becomes a little less boring.
Right. And let's just think practically. So let's just say you thought that your team could keep to 80% of their agreements. That was kind of what they historically did. They were only keeping to 80% of the things that they said they would do. So you could assume that 2 out of every 10 things that you asked them to do would just not get done and get lost somehow, right? Now, think about what kind of actions that makes you do. You have to continually follow up and check on each agreement to see if it's been missed or forgotten. You don't know which 2 they're not going to do, right? So you have to check all 10. And so as soon as you get a slight disintegration of trust there, then it makes you micromanage the whole system.
Yeah, and you actually probably stop delegating important work.
Yeah, and so it's really important that people keep their agreements. And at Clearbit, we make this really apparent because we use this term called impeccable agreements.
Impeccable agreements. Can you define that for us?
Sure. So there's 3 facets to an impeccable agreement. The first is it's recorded, and we use Asana for this. So it is recorded, it is precisely defined, so that's having a great description such that a third party could adjudicate if it was finished or not. And then the third facet is it's got to have a specific due date and owner. If a task has more than one owner, it has no owners. So it has a specific due date and owner.
Yeah. Okay. So this is an impeccable agreement. Can you give me an example of one that's impeccable versus one that is more ordinary?
Sure. So as you might imagine for this book and with the podcast accompanying it, we have quite a schedule. So there are all sorts of impeccable agreements associated with that schedule. So an impeccable agreement might be, I agree to finish this chapter by this time. And so that will have a good description on it, and it's got my face on it, I'm owning it, and it's got a specific due date. And so it's very clear if something has been finished or not finished, and it doesn't get lost because it's recorded in Asana. And an example of an agreement that is not impeccable that people often make with each other is they'll just say something to each other in passing. So it won't be specific, and it won't be stored, and it won't be owned.
Sure. So Natalie, who's been helping us with this project, might walk past and be say like, hey, will you have chapter 3 done by next week?
Right. And I might say, sure. And then that's lost if it's not recorded. And often you'll find that agreements aren't specific enough as well. So 2 people have different ideas of what it means.
Yeah. So what happens when life happens, when your priorities change, when you aren't going to be able to fulfill that agreement?
Well, the key thing is to remember is because now we have an agreement to complete everything that we agree to, The first thing is don't agree to too many things. So really only agree to the things that you can actually do. And then the second thing is, look, priorities change, life happens. Sometimes things don't even make sense to do anymore. At that point, you want to renegotiate the agreement. But you don't want to just let that agreement slide. So you go to the person that you made the agreement with and you say, look, I want to renegotiate this agreement because of all these circumstances. Can I do that?
I think one of the most dangerous things is getting in a rhythm or a pattern of saying, I'll get to that. And I haven't gotten to it, but I know I will. It's on my like big to-do list that just always gets bigger. It just creates this weight, erodes trust.
So one thing I like thinking about myself as a manager is my team's accountability partner. So every single one-on-one, I ask my team, what are the three most important things for you to get done by this time next one-on-one? And the key thing is I'm not telling my team what those three things are. They're telling me those three things. And I'm just their accountability partner. I'm just focusing them on the most important things. So as soon as they tell me those three most important things, I write them down in Asana. I set the due date. I set the owner. I write a description. And now those are impeccable. So come the next one-on-one, those have to be done. And if they're not done, then I make it super awkward. And I ask for a habit to try and make sure this doesn't happen again, to really demonstrate that it's just not acceptable.
Yeah, and very specifically, it's a why. So describe why this thing didn't happen and what habit can you change? And that habit should include a follow-up task or a calendar event often.
Yeah, you know, I even don't even care about the reason. It wasn't done. I just want to make sure that it doesn't ever happen again.
So we've talked a lot about giving feedback in one-on-ones and kind of this is feeding into that in the previous chapter. So let's actually jump forward a bit here and talk about another part of teamwork and working together as teams. Something that I really devalued for a long, long time, which is meetings.
Right. And so meetings are necessary in companies. You could think of them like carbon dioxide in the bloodstream that you need to get it out of the bloodstream, but it's part of running a successful company / body.
I think that's your second blood metaphor in two of these episodes.
Yeah, that's kind of concerning, isn't it? Okay, so here's my opinions on meetings. I bet you can't wait.
Can't wait.
The first is that it must be kept to an absolute minimum. The second is that they must be prepared for, so that the time allotted makes the best use of that time. They must have an owner, must have a note taker. They must have only precisely the number of people who need to attend. And the last thing is walk out of a meeting if you are not receiving or giving any value. A good thing is to make this as a company policy, so you're not going to ruffle any feathers when you walk out of the meeting.
Yeah, I think that one can be really challenging, especially if you're in a meeting culture where meetings are a place of social value.
Right. It's very, very dangerous, though, to make meetings a place of social value. You know, there are some cultures, like Google's is famous for being a culture of FaceTime. So you talk to Google employees, they need to go back down to Mountain View to have that FaceTime. Why? Because that FaceTime is key to them getting promoted. And so what is an easy way of getting FaceTime? Inviting someone to a meeting. And then you have all these frivolous meetings, and it's just awful. So making sure that you don't have a culture of FaceTime, you do not get promoted because you're getting extra FaceTime with the senior team. You're getting promoted just for results. And making sure that every second counts in those meetings because they're really expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a way to walk out of a meeting in a kind way. That is to very quickly interrupt and be like, I don't think I'm adding a lot of value here. If there's anything that you need me for, let's just cover it right now. If not, I'm going to take off.
Right. So let's talk about meeting owners. So every meeting needs to have an owner. This is the person who's justifying the meeting. They are justifying the company's investment in this meeting. So if you think about the hourly rate of everyone in that meeting, you know, times the number of people in that meeting, it's so expensive. Okay. So that person who's owning the meeting is on the hook for that. They have to make that time worth it. So the first thing they're going to do is prepare for that meeting. They're going to prepare an update. So if it's a recurring meeting, maybe, for example, at our leadership meeting, everyone there who's a stakeholder prepares an update. And you usually don't even need people at the meeting who are not one of those people. And at the start of those meetings, everyone then reads those updates. And we use Asana and all those updates and then tasks and their comments on tasks in Asana. And then you assign a note taker. So this is actually gets around one of the reasons why you get big meetings, right? So if you think about a meeting, it's an information sharing mechanism. And if you think about information, it's actually a hidden form of compensation. So a lot of companies will use information as compensation, basically. The managers are in the know. So I'm an individual contributor. I want to understand more about what's happening at the company. My manager's not telling me enough. What do I do? I attend the meeting. And there you get someone who didn't need to attend a meeting, attending that meeting. So the key thing is you get rid of that completely by having a note taker. So everything in the meeting that's discussed is written down. The notes are shared after the meeting. Anyone interested into what went on in that meeting, just read those notes.
I think the other interesting thing for that note taker is creating what we were talking about earlier, which is the agreements or the impeccable agreements that come out of that. So often meetings, their output is a bunch of follow-on tasks or even sometimes other meetings. But having someone who's responsible for recording that, putting the faces on them that belong on them, a proposed due date, super, super helpful.
Yeah, and this has to be different from the MC, mostly because it actually takes up a lot of cognitive power to do notes and you can't do both at the same time.
So many of our meetings are about making decisions. Let's talk about decision-making as a whole and how we think about that in Clearbit and how that interacts.
Okay, so there's various aspects to decision-making. And the first thing to remember is the writing is way more efficient communication mechanism than talking. So you want to be writing things down before making decisions on them. You don't want to just come to a meeting and discuss stuff without actually reading it first. And you might find that you don't even need a meeting. So at Clearbit, we'll have what we call issues and proposed solutions. So someone has a decision that needs to be made. They will write up that decision as an issue. Like, I need this resource, or I think this should happen. And then they have a proposed solution. And then they'll just share that Google Doc with people. And people can just comment at the bottom if they agree or disagree. Sometimes a meeting will be required, but often that actually negates the reason for a meeting.
I mean, that sounds good, but what do you say to people that are like, I don't have time. I'm back-to-back meetings all day, or back-to-back things all day, and I really need to talk with you to help make this decision. I don't have time to build a document with a proposed solution.
Well, that argument, I don't have time, never works for me. We all have the same amount of hours in the day. It's just a case of poor planning and prioritization. But I would say you're actually going to spend more time if you're just talking. A, you're going to spend more time just verbally saying things. B, you're just going to make the wrong decisions because not all the information is down there. And then you're going to have to make another decision. So it ends up being much faster writing.
Yeah, I think that's fair. My only caveat at all here is there are some people that seem to think through talking, and having a talking partner to think through problems is important. But I would almost always ask that that's not a multi-person meeting or a large meeting. One-on-one, one-on-two, small groups talking through problems, brainstorming, collaboration, great. But bringing 6-7 people together to do that, huge waste of time.
Yeah. You ever hear of Sherlock Holmes' skull?
Yeah.
We should get that for the office.
for people who aren't familiar.
Sherlock Holmes just used to have a skull on his mantelpiece that he would talk to whenever he needed someone else to bounce ideas off.
Or the engineer with the rubber duck.
Yes, right.
Continuing on the topic of decision making, we think about type 1 decisions versus type 2 decisions. And essentially it is a decision that you can take back versus a decision that you can't. Tell me how you think about that.
So this is the framework for delegating. So how you should think about delegating. And this is from Amazon's Jeff Bezos. I'm not sure if he invented it, but it was in his iconic shareholder letter in 2015. And he talks about the two types of decisions. And type 2 decisions are ones that are reversible and type 1s aren't. It's basically that simple. And so you don't want to delegate type 1 decisions because you just can't reverse them. Type 2 can be delegated. And then there's another framework called task-relevant maturity that you can use to determine if that should be delegated or not.
I also think the other thing with type 1 versus type 2 is speed. Type 2 decisions, because they can be reversed, you can make decisions with significantly less information and take less time to get there, where type 1 can have irreversible impact. And so it's worth taking the extra time and effort to make the most informed decision possible.
Yeah. So, Matt, question for you. Why would you delegate any kinds of decisions?
The most obvious reason to delegate decisions, period, is it increases your ability to work, right? Your ability, your output. Every single job we have has to make decisions. And if I was responsible or you were responsible for all the decisions at Clearbit, we'd be paralyzed.
That's right. So throughput is probably the main reason. I think there's two other reasons. One is that your team might have domain knowledge that you don't have. And then the third is that the decision might be so frivolous that it's a waste of your time to get involved.
I think to the second one, that is what we should be optimizing for in hiring, as people that can make better decisions than us in their areas of expertise. So what about when, well, what about you and I? We're trying to make a decision together. We have different opinions. What's our path?
Well, let's just say it's a type two decision. So for example, type one might be fundraising, adding someone to the cap table. Type two might be an investment in something. You want $70,000 to invest building out a wiki.
Or the manager's handbook.
Right. Okay. So let's just say I disagreed with you on that decision. There's another framework that Amazon pioneers, which is the phrase disagree and commit. Again, to save time. It's basically saying, look, I know we disagree on this, but I'm going to commit to your decision anyway. And it's a way of getting around any like seniority issues or lack of buy-in from upper management. And basically saying to your team, I trust you, and letting them run with their own decisions.
Yeah, and I think the other really important piece here, especially maybe less so for manager to report, but from peers, is I'm going to commit and I'm going to support this decision and try to make it work, right? My work, all of my effort was not going to be tainted by the fact that I had a different opinion.
Right. It's really important that once a team has made a decision, that everyone is aligned on actually, you know, going through with that. Otherwise, the decision might just fail anyway, just due to the lack of team alignment.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the word alignment, because that pairs really nicely into our next topic here. Love a good segue. Buy-in and alignment. How do we, like when we are presenting a decision or presenting an idea, how do we get everyone aligned around it well, get group buy-in before we move forward?
So the key thing to know here is that alignment and buy-in takes time, and there's no way of getting around that. The more buy-in you want for a decision, the more time it's going to take, because how do people get buy-in? Well, they feel like they were part of the decision.
And I think it's definitely the like more time now for, or yeah, spend more time now for less time later, and or vice versa. No time now and spend a lot later.
Yeah, so that's why you want buy-in. Now, some decisions don't require buy-in, and you shouldn't even try and get buy-in because it's just a waste of everyone's time. Some decisions do require a lot of buy-in, and it does take a lot of time. And like you said, it's worth that time investment, because in the long run, it's going to pay off if everyone's bought in.
So let's go through that. So the decisions that don't require buy-in, you make a decision or a manager makes a decision, announces it to the team. What happens next?
And well, they just announce it to the team, announce questions, but that's that. The decision is made. So that's got no buy-in from the team. And should mostly be used for things that doesn't require their buy-in, like what is the location of the holiday party?
I don't know. That took a lot of buy-in this year. All right. Moving down the gradient here, or up the gradient, what's next?
Okay. So the next type of buy-in, it takes a little longer. So the manager makes a written straw man. So this is a hypothetical proposed solution to inspire discussion and perhaps push it in a direction that the manager thinks it should be pushed in, and gives it to the team. So this takes more time, but it gets kind of the team half bought in, because they had a say. Even if things didn't go quite the way they wanted it to go, they had their say.
And this is actually how almost all type two decisions are made at Clearbit. A issue, here's my proposed solution of how I think I'm going to solve it. Quick check, do you guys agree? Or are you okay with me moving forward?
Right. And then the third type of buy-in is maximum buy-in. So this is when the team discusses the issue from scratch with no straw man. And then the final decision is determined by consensus, if possible.
Yeah. And so this creates the very most buy-in, but takes quite a bit of time up front. And the best examples of places like this would be OKRs.
Company values.
Company values. Yeah, that's a really good example. Okay, so we've covered these three different types of decision-making, gone through, you know, kind of the pros and cons there. Now that we've thought about decision-making, meetings, and agreements, one thing I really like to talk about here is remote and how all of this applies to remote teams versus in-person teams. What's different between the two? How should you manage these concepts differently?
So all of this is the same when it comes to decision-making and buy-in with remote, except it's a little harder because of the communication issues. And so for context, at Clearbit, we have 30% of the company that's remote. They're dotted across the country. I know your entire team is remote.
Yeah, almost entirely.
Right. And a lot of the engineering team is remote. And so we have to think really carefully about how we do remote, how we make the remote team feel included, and how we integrate them into our decision making.
Yeah. So I think there's three specific things that are very hard or harder with remote employees. The first is building trust. Because you're not in the office together, you don't have those same micro interactions, that smile, that high five, eating lunch next to someone. And so it just takes more work to build trust, takes a little bit longer. Also, clear communication is even harder. You can't go shoulder tap someone, or it's a lot harder to clarify something you don't understand. And then one that you alluded to is just the FUD of not being in the office, not having the information, and like not being around kind of your friends.
Yeah, I would add a fourth, I think, is loneliness. You know, we are a very social species. And so being at home on the laptop all day is just not a solution to happiness. So we've figured out a number of ways of solving for this. And building trust is the first one we're going to tackle. And that is a tough one to do because of our lizard brains. Zoom is not good enough to trick our lizard brain into thinking that we're in the same room as someone. And so our lizard brain does not trust someone fully unless they have been in the same room with them, they've broken bread with them, they had some amazing experiences with them, and they've maybe overcome some adversity with them. That's how you build trust. And so how do you do that with remote employees? Well, one thing is you actually just cheat by having them come to you. And so you'll notice that remote companies like Zapier, they spend as much on their offsites as we do on our office because they get meet up once, twice, three times a year. So what we do at Clearbit is we say, if you're remote, you can come to the office four times a year and every quarter, and we will pay for the whole thing. We'll pay for the hotels, the flights, the whole thing.
And we do a once a year offsite.
Yes. And we will go somewhere nice. And last year's, we've gone to Tulum and Costa Rica and Colombia. And these offsites are mostly around bonding. So what I say to people on these offsites is, don't work. You can do work at home, you know. Actually, just have fun with each other. Build trust, collaborate, just, you know, do some weird stuff. Go snorkeling or scuba diving and actually build some shared experiences.
Yeah, and as the company has gotten bigger, I've actually found that the individual team offsites, which we also do, every team can do one offsite almost anywhere in the world per year. And that, as the company gets bigger and bigger, that group becomes kind of the culture for each team, right? So it's very important that they have that time too.
It is. It is. One of the issues we've seen as we've grown is how do you build trust between teams? So we actually have quite a lot of inter-team trust across most of the teams. Where we start to see things break down is inter-team trust. And I think right now our solution to that is really clear planning and measurement. And we can talk about that in another podcast, but we have a whole set of OKRs and what we call the pyramid of clarity to try and build trust between teams. Let's talk about communication. So with remote people, like you said, you tend not to get as much communicated. You know, when two humans are communicating, a lot is lost just over audio. There's a lot of extra things. You know, our body language is lost if we were just talking to each other over the phone. So we always ask people to turn their cameras on, and we always try and include them in the conversation. One issue when you're dialing into a call and you're dialing into the office where there are a few people that are sitting next to each other, and maybe you're the one or two people who are remote, is how do you interject? because you have that latency, and that latency will always be there. You know, we got the speed of light limitation, right?
And that's why we have this thing like the remote spotter, whose job it is to call back to remote. If we haven't heard from them in a while, let's pause the conversation and see what they have to add.
Yeah, because it can be really hard to know when to interject when you're remote. The other thing we can do, and we've done this successfully a few times, is have everyone dial in remote. And so everyone's on the same playing field. But sometimes that's just not possible because the office isn't big enough.
Another constraint for sure. I think another thing, or two other things that I find that help a lot with the information piece and making people feel like they have access, is one, pairing. I think it's easy to forget that pairing doesn't just have to be for engineers. The idea of two people getting together remotely and working on a project together is such a good way of not only getting something done, but sharing all of the context that you might have or they might have about something at the same time.
Right. So that basically simulates someone just jamming in an office. Another way of simulating an office interaction is with something called a donut. So again, something you would normally lose out on if you were remote is that interaction just casually at the, you know.
Like water cooler, hey, let's go grab a coffee.
Exactly. Yep.
And let's be clear, we didn't build Donut. It's an app you can go use.
Right. And it will just ping you over Slack and set you up with someone in the randomly in the company every couple of weeks, I think.
Yeah, I think it's every 2 weeks.
Yeah. And so then you might meet someone that you would never otherwise meet.
Yep. And it's unstructured time to talk about. Often we end up talking about the work we're working on because that's what we have in common. But yeah.
I've used the 29 questions to fall in love.
Oof, unsubscribe.
So the last thing I want to talk about remote is personal responsibility. So there's only so much the company can do. So the key thing is to hire people who've done remote before, because it takes a special kind of individual to actually enjoy remote. And they need to be really strict with themselves. And they need to develop a routine. You know, they need to go outside, speak to other real people, you know. And they also need to be really careful about not letting their work just slip into their personal life. So we ask people to take responsibility. And in Slack, for example, set the status when they're out of the office and not work late into the evening. All right. So to recap what we talked about today, we first talked about impeccable agreements. So setting the standard that all agreements have to be completed and only agreeing to the ones that you can actually complete. We talked about running meetings, setting an owner, setting a note taker, preparing for the meeting. We talked about decision-making, the different types of buy-in, type one, type two decisions, disagree and commit. And then lastly, we talked about remote teams. So this is about building trust, communication, playing games, having fun with your remote team, inviting them to offsites, and inviting them to the main office. So those are the things that we covered today.
One last thing I'd like to spend just a little bit of time on before we jump off here is, how do we know if we're doing well as managers across these things? And how do we improve on them if we're not?
Well, we can absolutely delve into that. So how do you measure a manager's performance is the question, right? And there, ultimately, a manager is measured by that team's output, right? What is their leverage? What is your investment in them? And what do you get back from that investment? But that's only one facet, and it tends to not be a leading indicator. It might be the ultimate indicator, but it's not leading. So how do you ascertain manager's performance in the meantime? So what we actually do is we use the Gallup 12 survey, which measures employee engagement. And these are 12 questions that can be used across any company. And Gallup has shown that they are highly correlated with engagement, and engagement is highly correlated with sticking around a company and high performance. So there are 6 esteem needs questions and 6 self-actualization questions. Esteem needs being the fundamental one, self-actualization being the cherry on top. So an example of esteem needs question might be, do I know what's expected of me at work? Do I have the opportunity to do what I do best every day? Is there someone at work who encourages my development? And then a self-actualization question might be, at work, do my opinions seem to count? Do I have a best friend at work? Has someone talked to me about my progress?
Yeah, so I kind of think of that as like the esteem as, do I know that I'm doing a good job, or do I know that my work matters? And the self-actualization is,
am I growing? Am I becoming the next version of myself here? Am I around people that I want to be around all the time?
Right. And so what we do is once a quarter, we send out a survey to the entire company. And we actually do the survey in the all hands to force people to fill it in. And we ask these 12 questions. And it's anonymous. They just fill in the name of their manager and the answers to these 12 questions, the scores out of 10. And then we just do a pivot on that table. And then we can see exactly how well each manager is doing from the results of the survey.
Yep. And we can share it with them and look at it quarter over quarter. For more information on Gallup and exactly how we use it, go check out the chapter. I think the other most useful tool in our arsenal as managers of knowing how well we're doing is kind of tying back to that one-on-one feedback, which I think we alluded to in the last chapter. How can we think about tracking that over time? Or how do you think about that as you think about your performance as a manager?
Well, I use a combination of tools. I first use written feedback that we have in Asana. The second thing is I use Torch. So I have a coach, and Torch is essentially a coaching framework, and that bakes in things like 360 reviews.
Learning goals.
So learning goals is one of these things. So for example, I am trying to get better at aligning the company around a mission and public speaking. These are the two things. And so I have a learning goal about that. And every 3 weeks, 6 key people in the company, across the company, not just the leadership team, get pinged. And they anonymously answer how well I'm doing against this goal. And it gives me some quantifiable metric as to my progress on the problem.
Your growth points.
Yeah, precisely.
And I will want to call it another tool here as well, which is Modern Health, another coaching platform that everyone at Clearbit has access to and that a lot of people have used as well. Well, we've covered quite a lot today, and that brings us to the end of chapter 4. Any final thoughts on working as a team before we sign off, Alex?
Group projects are hard, and as a manager, that's your entire job. You know, it's super important to have a support system and a framework for measuring your success.
Couldn't agree more. All right. Thank you, everyone. You've been listening to the Manager's Handbook podcast. You can find more info and follow along at themanagershandbook.com. Thank you so much for listening. This podcast is being recorded at Studio Pod SF. For more information, go to studiopodsf.com. Thank you for listening.